Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. 4 years ago today, in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, healthcare workers at Memorial Medical Center in New Orleans made some decisions that are still being examined. The hospital was essentially isolated. There was no power because the building was in about 10 feet of water. Patients had to be evacuated, but it was unclear how best to do that. So the staff struggled with several decisions and some life-and-death decisions. And those decisions led to the arrests of a doctor and two nurses on charges of administering lethal doses of drugs to 9 patients. But a New Orleans grand jury declined to return indictments. And the physician, Dr. Anna Poe, defended herself on CBS's 60 Minutes in 2006.
I did not murder those patients. I did the best I could under these dreadful conditions that were created by the fact that we were abandoned.
Today we're going to hear about a new investigation into what happened at Memorial Medical Center. The investigation is featured in this week's New York Times Magazine and on the website ProPublica. Dr. Sherry Fink wrote the story, and she joins us from New York. Sherry, welcome.
Thank you.
Before we get into some of the questions raised about the possibility of euthanasia at Memorial Medical Center in New Orleans, remind us exactly of what the conditions were like 4 years ago today, right after Katrina hit.
Katrina came very early on a Monday morning. Tuesday morning, the floodwaters started to rise around the hospital, and very quickly they realized that they would have to evacuate. There was a vulnerability in this hospital, as there are in many, many hospitals in America, where the backup power systems are below flood level. And they knew that they could lose all power to the hospital. So quickly they decided to evacuate the sickest patients, the patients who required air conditioning, and those who relied on machines like ventilators. But there was a subset of patients who were not evacuated first. The doctors decided to put last in the evacuation line, and those were the people who had, quote, do not resuscitate orders, an order that a doctor can prescribe, and usually it's in conjunction with a patient or their family members just not wanting CPR, not wanting the heart to be restarted.
It doesn't mean critically ill then necessarily. What it means is that do not restart their heart.
That's right. That's technically what it means. Often it goes with somebody who's critically ill, but not always. But in this hospital, there was a decision made early on that those patients would be last in line for evacuation. And what happened throughout the next day, when suddenly the helicopters coming to fly people out of this hospital stopped coming, the hospital did lose all power. It became very, very hot inside. There was no running water. The toilets backed up. It smelled terribly. Patients had been moved out of their rooms, away from the nurses and doctors who usually cared for them, and they were staging in a lounge area on the second floor of this hospital. And their conditions just worsened and worsened as time passed. And we all know the larger failures of response to Katrina. This hospital really felt it. They were not getting the evacuation resources they need. So by 2 days into that, on Thursday, September 1st, that's when some of these decisions that you were referring to started to be made.
And the sickest patients were on the seventh floor of Memorial Hospital, and that floor was leased out by the company known as Life Care Hospitals. It was sort of a hospital within a hospital for very sick patients.
That's right. And for some reason, when the decision to pick out a group of people to evacuate first was made, the ICU patients, et cetera, nobody really talked about what to do about Life Care. This, as you mentioned, long-term acute care, generally people who need to stay in a hospital for quite a period of time because they might have multiple medical problems, a lot of them requiring ventilators. They, too, did not get evacuated in that first wave. And then the staff on Wednesday, when the helicopter stopped coming, decided to go into a mode where they got the healthiest people out first for practical reasons and for other reasons. That was the decision they made. So these patients, too, on the seventh floor, also began to languish and to suffer the effects of heat and delayed evacuation.
And Dr. Anna Poe is really the focus of your story. She was the physician in charge at the time. Can you explain to us how she was eventually arrested and charged with euthanizing some patients? And then, of course, the grand jury declined to return any indictments.
Well, I should say Dr. Poe wasn't in charge per se. She's a self-starter and very energetic and very dedicated type of doctor. So she worked harder than just about anybody there. But she did take charge of the patients on the seventh floor at some point, according to the life care staff, who said that she came upstairs and said, "Your patients are not going to be evacuated. We need to give them some medicine." One of the staff members remembered her saying the words, quote, "lethal dose." Other staff members didn't remember that. They thought she might have just said, "I'm coming up here to make people comfortable." And Dr. Poe herself, as you said, has argued that she was only up there to treat pain and anxiety of these patients. But what happened was that all the patients who she was then seen, she and some nurses were then seen injecting patients, all of those patients died within a few hours and were found to have these drugs in their systems that in most cases had not been prescribed for them. They hadn't been getting them from their healthcare workers until that point. And so then there was this investigation that took place, and there was a lot of outrage in New Orleans that of all the failures that you were going to arrest somebody over, it would be a doctor who really argued that she was just doing her best to try to help people. And so this was a big controversy in the city, and really a lot of people reacted when these health workers were arrested.
You talk with several people who haven't spoken publicly about being at Memorial Medical Center before, and you also highlight some cases that we haven't heard much about before, and among them is the case of Emmett Everett. Can you tell us about him?
Sure. Well, I think when we think about giving medicine to people to speed their deaths, obviously that's not something that American medical ethics typically allows for. But perhaps people could understand it if it was a person who was really close to death, had a few hours left, and there were these extreme conditions. And I do talk about certain cases in the hospital that really seem to fit that. But there are others that are more disturbing, and Mr. Everett is one of them. He was paraplegic. He had multiple medical problems, but he was awake, alert, fed himself breakfast, and asked his nurses, "Are we ready to rock and roll?" that morning. And he, too, died within a few hours with these drugs found in his system.
And when he asked that question of the nurses, meaning, are they ready to get him out of there?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. He was a bit concerned. He was very heavy set. And many people told me who were involved in transporting patients that they could have moved Mr. Everett. But what witnesses say is that when Dr. Poe came up and made this announcement, they pointed out that Mr. Everett was very aware and not dying, as maybe some other patients were, that they decided that he was just too heavy to move, that there weren't the resources to do it, that it would be impossible. And that's all we know, these witnesses to this conversation saying that this occurred.
And basically, his weight would have been an issue because getting him to the helipad, to the helicopter, was a difficult process.
This was an extremely difficult process. This would require carrying him down from the seventh floor to the second floor, passing him through a 3-by-3-foot hole in a wall that was a shortcut to the parking garage, where he would then be put on the back of a truck, driven up to the top of that garage, and then carried up 2 flights of open metal stairs up to the helipad. And this is all, of course, because there's no electricity to power the hospital's elevators. So this was not an easy task, but the story does show that there was another patient of similar size to Mr. Everett who was taken out this way. So that does raise questions. And I think you said about other things that hadn't been known before. That was really my goal here, was to try to figure out what it was that did happen and what we might learn from it. And indeed, 2 very brave doctors, I should say, did tell me that they participated in injecting some other patients at the hospital, and they said that the goal was to hasten death.
Before we talk about those other 2 doctors, Sherry, I'm wondering, in terms of Emmett Everett, his particular case was actually the 1 second-degree murder charge that Dr. Poe faced. It was prepared by the Attorney General of New Orleans, and the grand jury declined to indict. So it felt that there was really not enough evidence there to suggest that there had been any kind of lethal injection, and Dr. Poe herself says that Emmett Everett died of a heart condition. So what do you make of the grand jury not feeling that there was enough evidence, and Dr. Poe's defense saying that this was a heart condition?
Grand juries, they meet in secret, so it's very hard to know exactly what it was that they heard. I was able to pull some information together, and that's in the article about the process. But basically, they were tasked to look at this issue of whether this was second-degree murder, which in Louisiana requires intent to kill somebody. that would be different than, say, somebody who perhaps gave medicines thinking that they were comforting somebody and gave a little too much and inadvertently killed someone, which would be a different charge. So they had to look at this charge of second-degree murder. However, grand juries also have no standard that they have to adhere to. They don't have a standard of beyond reasonable doubt. They can make technically any decision that they want to. We do know that the coroner decided that Mr. Everett's case was a homicide. Many medical experts looked at his medical records, his autopsy, et cetera, and they felt that he did die because of these drugs. Dr. Poe's lawyer told us that he is asserting that Mr. Everett died of an enlarged heart, but I haven't seen any evidence to support that, and they are facing a wrongful death lawsuit from Mr. Everett's family.
Now, you mentioned two brave doctors who were there who came forward. Why don't you tell us a little bit about them? I'm assuming that the first one you're talking about is Dr. John Thiel. He's a pulmonologist who never before spoke publicly about Hurricane Katrina and about being at Memorial Medical Center. What did he tell you?
Well, he told me that he came upon Dr. Poe. This was not on the seventh floor, which we'd heard so much about, these life care patients where Mr. Everett was. But then just shortly thereafter, that Dr. Poe had come down to the second floor, and there were about 10 patients there. They all had been given, most of them, I think, threes, which was this triage priority numbering system that they had created for the hospital. And the threes, it was decided that they would go last. They were the sickest patients, and they would be evacuated after the healthier people. So these people were lying in a lounge area on the second floor. He came upon Dr. Poe, and she was injecting medicines. There were some nurses there. There were morphine and midazolam, which is a fast-acting sedative, set out with syringes on a table, and he took charge of four of the patients there. He told me that they appeared close to death, and he's a very experienced physician, so that was his judgment. His rationale, he said that these were comfort medicines that they would give normally in an ICU setting, but he gave more than he would normally, and he gave it with the goal of hastening death. And he said that what was happening at that moment was that finally the evacuation resources had converged on the hospital. Everybody was trying to get out. And he felt that there was a real fear that people from the neighborhood, and remember all the rumors that were going around about violence, and these people in this hospital had been hearing gunshots go off. Boats would pull up to help take people out, and they would tell rumors about horrible violence going on in the city. So he was very, very afraid, and he thought that this was their chance to leave. But if they left these patients, these poor, helpless patients behind, he was literally afraid that marauding gangs would come in to try to get drugs from the hospital and rape these patients and, do horrible things to them. So that was what was in his mind when he turned to four of the patients and gave these medicines.
So he basically admits euthanizing some of these patients.
He admits that his goal was to hasten deaths of people who he thought were going to die soon anyways.
And Dr. Thiel's comments were never given to investigators, is that right?
That's right. Investigators never spoke with Dr. Thiel. That's why I said that he also was brave to talk about what happened, kind of let the public know what it was that happened there and what they felt was right.
And who was the other doctor that you said came forward, another brave doctor who came forward in this case?
That was Dr. Ewing Cook, another pulmonologist at the hospital, very widely respected in the community, had actually just retired from clinical practice, so he'd been there for several decades at the hospital. He described for me the case of one particular do-not-resuscitate patient who was up in the ICU and had stayed there after all the other ICU patients had been evacuated. She was very, very sick with uterine cancer and thought not to have much longer to live. She was already under sedation with the drug morphine. She wasn't conscious. She was pretty much in a coma with that medicine, just keeping her very, very comfortable. And when he walked upstairs and saw the condition that she was in, he saw that four nurses were up there taking care of her. He himself had had two heart attacks, couldn't imagine ever being able to walk back up those staircases again to get up there. And he also was afraid that if they tried to move this patient, that her sedation might wear off and she would wake up in just this terrible circumstance. So he asked a nurse whether they could increase the morphine, give her enough until she goes. And the nurse agreed, and Dr. Cook signed his name in the patient's chart, put something like time of death, and left it blank for the nurse to fill in, and And that's what he did. And he told me that to this day, he feels that that was the right thing for this patient.
So Dr. Thiel admits that there were lethal doses of sedatives given to some patients. Dr. Eaming Cook also admits that there were lethal doses given to some patients in this particular case. And despite those statements from both of those doctors, there hasn't been any formal charge against anybody involved for those lethal doses of sedatives to patients.
Well, a couple of things. First of all, the story just came out on Sunday, and neither of those two had spoken with investigators during the investigation of Dr. Poe. So I think that perhaps this wasn't known about to anybody, really.
But I think the big question is, why wouldn't they have spoken to investigators?
Perhaps they were potential targets of an investigation, and I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. But in any case, we know that they didn't, that wasn't part of the investigation. And the other thing that I really like to focus on is that whether it technically fits a crime, you know, the definition of a crime. Second of all is whether you would want to prosecute that. And again, we have to step back and say, what was the condition under which these decisions were being made? It was hot. It was, people were desperate. Dr. Cook told me, you know, you're never supposed to use the word desperate, but it was desperate. People felt like they, you know, it turned out not to be true that this was a choice between abandoning patients and hastening their deaths, because the evacuation resources did converge on that hospital. And that, I think, kind of highlights the danger of, or the importance, let's say, of when you are dealing with limited resources, that you're always reassessing what you have and what you need, and not letting yourself get into the situation where you believe that there are certain patients who will never make it out, for example.
We looked on the comments in the New York Times magazine website, and the New York Times website apparently has stopped accepting comments because this story struck such a nerve. And many people say, we cannot judge these doctors for what they did. It was an unimaginable situation, and we weren't there. It's very difficult to understand what was going through their minds and exactly what the conditions were in which these doctors made these decisions.
That's right. And there's a difference between judging and learning from something. And I think that this is a case where we can try to understand what happened. This grand jury didn't indict Dr. Poe, and the story kind of went away, and nobody knew what happened. And in fact, I spoke with the professors at a military medical university, which they were using this case to teach military medical students about these ethical issues, but there was no knowledge about what it was that had actually happened. So before we can learn something, we need to know what it was that went on. And I think that's very important. And people like Dr. Poe are promoting new laws, new standards for future disasters. And I think that we need to know what it was that their experiences were before we can, as a society, judge whether we want to support those things.
Yeah, and Dr. Poe has said that folks with do not resuscitate orders should be evacuated last, and there should be a protocol followed almost like the one that was implemented in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. Do you think that it will become maybe medical protocol?
Well, here's the thing. There are efforts to change the standards of care in disasters, and they haven't gotten a lot of attention from the public. And this is the idea that doctors and nurses may not be able to live up to normal medical standards in a disaster. That is clear. Everybody knows that. The question is whether we should change protocols and kind of codify those decisions, like putting the sickest patients last for evacuation. We need a conversation about these things.
Dr. Sherry Fink wrote about the death of several patients at Memorial Medical Center in New Orleans in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. Her article appeared in the New York Times Sunday Magazine and on the ProPublica website. Sherry, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Today in Idaho, the hunt begins for wolves. For the first time in decades, gray wolves can be legally hunted in the continental United States. Although wolves were once nearly extinct in North America, and the gray wolf was placed on the endangered species list in 1974, since then the wolf population has thrived in the Northern Rockies. In May, the federal government said the animal is no longer endangered, but only in Idaho and Montana. So in those states, officials have issued thousands of wolf hunting licenses. But the wolves could get a reprieve from a judge in Montana. Joining us from Helena, Montana, is reporter Eve Byron. She's with the Helena Independent Record. Hello, Eve.
Hello, Deborah.
Well, with wolf hunting season underway in Idaho today, and it's scheduled to be underway in Montana in a few weeks, there was a last-minute hearing yesterday to try to block the hunting. Could it stop today, the day it starts in Idaho?
It could. It's up to Judge Malloy whether he issues an injunction.
And the folks asking for an injunction are asking for one. Why?
Because they don't believe that wolves have fully recovered. They think that we need to have more wolves on the landscape, and they also don't believe that there's the genetic diversity that they need to have in order to be fully recovered.
And then the folks who want to hunt the wolves, they're saying that they should be allowed to hunt. Why?
Well, they're using hunting as a management tool in order to better deal with wolves on the landscape. Right now, there's a lot of depredation of livestock that's been taking place. They're also concerned of the impact that wolves are having on other populations like elk and deer. They're seeing some lower numbers there, and a lot of people are blaming that on the wolves.
So what sort of specific stories are you hearing in terms of livestock?
There was a ranch. They had some kills in July. 26 buck sheep were killed in July in this pasture. And then just 2 weeks ago, the wolves came back in, and there were a total of 122 animals that died during this August incident that were confirmed wolf kills. And that was more than the total number of sheep that were killed last year.
So let's look at the history of this a little bit. The judge here that you mentioned, Judge Malloy, he did stop a planned wolf hunt in Idaho last year. So do you think incidents like the one you just mentioned, where all of those sheep were killed by wolves, will that affect things this time around or not?
I'm not sure if it will or not. The judge has to look basically on the law, because this time around, this is the third time that they've made a run at delisting the wolves, the federal government has. And the first time they included all of Wyoming, Idaho, and Montana. But what happened in Wyoming was they set up a wolf hunting season. Basically, they said all wolves are predators except if they're outside of the greater Yellowstone area. And they listed them as predators that could be shot on sight. That was one of the things that the judge didn't like in the first go-round of the delisting. But the problem is the folks who don't want them to list it right now, they say you cannot have them be an endangered species in one state and then have them not be endangered in two adjoining states.
Hmm. Now, as we said, there are thousands of people are trying to get wolf hunting licenses, so this seems very popular. Why is that? Is this for sport? Why do people want to hunt wolves?
Well, as of this morning, they have issued about 3,000 hunting licenses in Montana. People have different reasons for buying them. Some people just don't like wolves. One gentleman I spoke with said he wanted to send a message that Montana has too many wolves, and he will actually go hunting for wolves. Other people, they are buying the wolf licenses just in case they see one when they're out hunting elk or deer. Other people are buying these licenses because it's never been issued before, and they're planning on framing it.
Framing the license?
Uh-huh.
Hmm. Not really hunting?
No. There's just a lot of divergent opinions on them.
As we said, the judge could issue a ruling as soon as today, but any idea of, and he has said he'll do so as quickly as possible, but do you think it'll happen as soon as this week?
Yes, I'm certain that he will issue something this week. My understanding is he just had a lot of information that he needed to digest, and he wants to make sure that he does the right thing.
Eve Byron reports for the Helena Independent Record in Helena, Montana. Eve, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
And we'll be back in just 30 seconds with a look at the controversy over allowing military women to serve in combat. It's Here and Now. In the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, women are fighting and dying alongside their male colleagues, even though they're technically not allowed to be in combat roles. More than 100 American women have died in the two wars. This summer, Britain saw its first female soldier killed in Afghanistan, and at least five British women have been killed in Iraq. We want to spend some time on this topic with two guests. First, the BBC's Lucy Williamson. She's been reporting on this, and she joins us from London. Welcome, Lucy.
Hello.
Also joining us is Paula Broadwell. She's a West Point graduate, an Army veteran. She's now at the Center for Public Leadership at Harvard's Kennedy School, and she's a major in the Army Reserves. Hi, Paula.
Good afternoon.
Lucy, I'd like to ask you first. The death of the British soldier that we talked about this past summer, Sarah Bryant, she was killed in Afghanistan. Was she killed in combat, and can you explain the reaction to her death?
She was on a support operation in the Helmand province of Afghanistan, and she was traveling in an armored car with several of her colleagues, actually. The car was hit by a roadside bomb, and four of those on that mission were killed, including Corporal Bryant. The reaction was quite strong. I mean, firstly, as you say, because she was the first woman soldier killed from our forces out in Afghanistan, but also because she was 26 years old, blonde, very pretty, very feminine, and of course that sparked quite a lot of press coverage and also quite a lot of soul searching, I think, about the kind of roles that women were playing out in places like Afghanistan.
Paula, you recently wrote an editorial that was published in the Boston Globe about women in combat, and your basic argument is that women are already in combat. It's time to change the rules. Why is that?
We've had 13 American women die in Afghanistan, but it hasn't made the press. In fact, I had to look that number up and corroborate it in a couple of different locations. But as Lucy has also said, women are serving in combat. We have been for the last 15 years. And what's happening is both the U.S. and the U.K. militaries and other militaries are going through an adaptation, and whether that means the battlefield and peacekeeping and stability operations and countering insurgencies, but it also means we don't have enough forces to meet some of the tasks that are required on the battlefield.
Mm. Hey, Paula, you sent us a list of some of the American women who have been killed in Afghanistan. First Lieutenant Laura Walker, she was 24 years old. She died when an IED blew up her Humvee. Also Reserve Sergeant First Class Meredith Howard died in a suicide car bomb attack on her Humvee. So obviously women in dangerous roles. So basically your argument is they're doing this anyway. We don't have enough troops, and we really need to revise our policy to give them the opportunity to serve as fully as their male colleagues do?
Women want to serve, and we need them to serve. So it's simply a matter of updating the policy. And that requires leadership. There's a cultural resistance, I think, in some of the top brass to changing these policies. But fortunately, General Petraeus, General McChrystal, and others know that women are at the point of the spear and that they'll be there in the foreseeable future.
Lucy, you've spoken with folks who are critical of allowing women to have full, technically appropriate combat roles. What do they say about women in combat?
The arguments against women serving on the front line in combat roles are well rehearsed, and they're basically that they're not as strong as men. And so, for example, when under fire, under attack, they couldn't pick up and drag their fallen comrades as easily as a man could. They couldn't carry equipment as far or as fast as a man could. There's also arguments about morale. People have said that when you have unequal strengths within a team, particularly between genders, it then destroys morale within that team. You get sexual relations, which can result in pregnancy, that can destroy morale when people are suddenly pulled out of a team. And there's the issue of sexual violence, which some service women have been talking about.
And basically, you've spoken with critics who say really the problem here is that it undermines the entire system. Is that right?
That's right. And one of the most vocal is Elaine Donnelly, who heads the Center for Military Readiness. That's a group that lobbies against women in frontline units in the U.S.
I would challenge the Department of Defense, the Army, defend your case, but make it in terms not of equal opportunity or careers. Make the case in terms of military necessity. You see, if your standard is careers first and military necessity second, then almost anything goes.
Paula Broadwell, what's your response to that comment from Elaine Donnelly from the Center for Military Readiness?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question. I actually had the privilege to interview all of the active duty female general officers last year when I wrote an article on breaking through brass ceilings. And those officers, the overwhelming remarks from them were that if you put mission first and career second and you get the job done, then they'll continue to rise in leadership positions. And those officers, those senior female military officers, felt like the combat exclusion policy was the number one factor holding them back from achieving the highest opportunities in the military. Of course, they were still very proud to serve, but they felt like that was an impediment that could be easily removed. They're serving in some of the same capacities as their senior ranking male general officers, so why not just remove the exclusion policy and allow them to continue to rise in ranks?
Lucy, you spoke with a female soldier who served in Iraq, working with male Marines. Her name is Shannon Morgan. Can you tell us about her?
Yeah, well, she would definitely have agreed with Paula. She said that she carried exactly the same weights as her male colleagues, did everything that they did. There was no allowances made physically for her being a woman. She was able to do all of that. She was one of a group of women who have been attached to the US Marines in Iraq, and partly they carry out roles that men, for cultural reasons, it's quite difficult for men to do. But she herself told me that she was the best with a machine gun in her team. She said she could throw down more rounds than her male colleagues, and that they all knew that, and that she was the one who covered them while they came under fire.
If we're being asked to do these missions and fulfill these new roles as basically infantry soldiers, I think that the government needs to take another look and say, hey, if we're going to let them play Army and play infantry, why can't we let them be infantry?
If you had had the chance, Paula, would you have volunteered for combat?
Well, I have the chance right now as a reservist, and it's likely with the threat horizon that I'll be called up again. And I've been involuntarily mobilized 3 times, and I love the military and will continue to support it. I think that for women, for men in the military, again, this is an adaptation. And it's the same thing that the military academies went through in the late 70s and early 80s. When women were first admitted in 1976 to the military academy, some of the long gray line, the old core, thought that the institution was destined to be ruined. And women have adapted very nicely there. In 2008, I think we had the largest number of women entrants. We have an 80% graduation rate for women. Some of those women graduate very top academically in their class. I graduated first physically in my class, beating all of my male counterparts. So if there are standards set and an individual, regardless of gender, can meet those standards, I think they should have an opportunity to serve.
Paula Broadwell is a major in the Army Reserves and a research associate with the Center for Public Leadership at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. We also spoke with the BBC's Lucy Williamson. By the way, she says women comprise about a fifth of the British military force in Afghanistan right now. And before we go today, a trio of stars from diverse backgrounds combined talents on a CD showcasing Western, Indian classical, and American roots music. That's new work from Bela Fleck, Edgar Meyer, and Zakir Hussain just ahead. You're listening to Here and Now. Welcome back to Here and Now. What do you hear when you put together a double bass player recognized with a MacArthur Foundation Genius Grant, an internationally renowned Indian percussionist, and a multiple Grammy-winning banjo virtuoso? Well, if those three musical giants are Edgar Meyer, Zakir Hussain, and Bela Fleck, what you'll hear is something like their new CD, The Melody of Rhythm. It's a melding of Western and Indian classical and American roots music, with all three musicians contributing their own compositions. This is Bubbles by Bela Fleck. The three musicians started working together in 2005 when Bela and Edgar were commissioned to write a concerto. They then decided that their dream would be to collaborate with Zakir Hussain. That dream was realized with the triple concerto, The Melody of Rhythm, which is on the CD performed by the trio with the Detroit Symphony Orchestra. Bela, Edgar, and Zakir like working together so much, they're taking their show on the road this fall, and they're on the line to talk about this and their collaboration. From KUOW in Seattle, we have Bela Fleck. Welcome, Bela.
Glad to be here.
And with us from KQED in San Francisco is Zakir Hussain. Nice to speak with you, Zakir.
Nice to speak with you, too.
And on the phone line there from Aspen, Colorado, is Edgar Meyer. Edgar, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much for having us.
Bela and Edgar, as we said, for you, Zakir Hussain was your dream collaborator. Edgar, why was that?
We've been very big fans since we were, you know, half this age or younger. But he brings a knowledge of a lot of different music, starting with Indian classical music, but wide range of experience in almost every kind of music that I'm aware of.
Working with someone so venerated and ancient, I felt I had a lot to learn from a gentleman like that.
Ancient?
No, I've been a fan of Zakir. I think when he plays his tabla, It's just pure music, and I was really curious to see how we would combine all these worlds.
Well, let's talk about those different points of view, because it is fascinating that the three of you come from very different musical backgrounds. Where do you think your musical influences sort of come together?
First of all, it is a great honor to be playing with these two incredible musicians and friends and now family. I mean, when that kind of a relationship gets established between people, the music takes on a very special connection. It's from the heart. And in this collaboration, for me, it has been a great learning experience to watch an Indian melody emerge and then how it suddenly transforms through Edgar's vision of a Western classical point of view and how Bela just takes it and makes it so incredibly rooted in an earthy folk vision. And when all this comes together, that melody just assumes a kind of shape and form and beauty that is so unbelievably unique.
This is Bahar by Zakir Hussain, performed by the three of you. And Bela, describe for me a little bit about the creative process and how that worked.
I think we just all wanted to be ourselves together. And because everyone has a very strong personality musically, if we could all find a way to do our best, you know, to be in a comfortable zone where we could do our thing and yet be stretched enough to not do it the way we always do it with everybody else we play with. We would all be happy with what came out.
One thing that is a special pleasure for me is that everybody thinks like a composer. Nobody's super worried about trying to get this lick in or that lick in there. You know, at the same time, you feel all three people trying to see the whole song wherever they are in it.
Well, let's listen to Cadence right now. Let's listen to that one.
More fun, probably more than the two of you, because I was made to feel that I could do whatever it is that I wanted to do and whatever I could think of doing. And even with the concerto in a classical orchestral form environment, I was allowed to stay more loose and open and play as I felt the piece on that day or in that performance. And so that kind of freedom still allowed me to be, you know, more from my part of the world, where improvising is a very important element of the creative process.
Right, but Bela. For me, this is Bela here. My challenge playing the concerto piece was playing 30 minutes of written out music, highly orchestrated, arranged, and some of it very technically demanding, which is something I think that Edgar does, you know, has been doing since he started playing. That's just part of the life of the classical musician.
And Zakir, did you also find that challenging? Because improvising, as you said, is such a big part of what you do musically.
Yeah, well, you know, we learn music orally in India, and so we don't write anything. And the idea is to just take all that information, put it in your head. But when you're on the stage playing an orchestral piece, which is a piece that is fixed, for me, it was the challenge was to be able to remember what's coming next, because I didn't have a chart in front of me.
Well, let's listen to a little more of the Triple Concerto, The Melody of Rhythm, played with the Detroit Symphony Orchestra. What happens when you add an orchestra? Does that change the relationship among the three of you? Edgar?
It does. I mean, because it's not the three of us anymore. It's the 83 of us.
It's a little more complicated.
Yes. You know, we have something like half of the total amount of the music, so in a sense, we lead. But in another sense, we're just a big 83-person group, and everybody has to listen to everybody and make music together.
You've mentioned the relationship that the three of you have and how you're like family and that chemistry and how that contributes to your performance. But you're all very separate musicians. So when you're touring and you're away from each other, is it challenging to try to recreate that chemistry to get back into that feeling that you need to make this music?
I think it happens the minute we start playing together.
Yes,
it
does.
It only gets easier.
Yeah. We just start from where we left off. And it usually begins with Edgar saying, oh, I made a great fish curry the other day.
I'm actually making a tenderloin curry tonight.
Oh, boy, there we go. You
see? And how's the curry, Zach, here?
Edgar is now becoming a master at curriness.
He's currying favor with Zakir.
He is most certainly is currying favor with me. And I'm trying to, you know.
Yeah, when we first got together, Edgar used to fry up spam for me, and it worked about the same.
What do you think it sounds like, anyway? There will be more collaborations in the future.
Yes, oh, like most certainly I'm going to look into that possibility of spam curry.
Yes, spam. A new collaboration. That's what we should have called the album, Spam Curry.
All right, well, banjo virtuosa Bella Fleck, tabla master Zakir Hussain, and double bass MacArthur genius Edgar Meyer, their new CD is The Melody of Rhythm. Thanks to all three of you for being with us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Deborah Becker. Please join us again. Here and Now.